Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
Historians love to argue about the drivers of history. Who are the agents of change? Is it kings and queens, or institutions, or explorers sailing oceans? Or perhaps, is it the oceans themselves? It's time to eat the dogs. I'm Michael Robinson. Today, Helen Roswedowski talks about the history of the oceans and how these oceans have shaped human history in really profound ways. Roswedowski is a professor of history at the University of Connecticut, Avery Point. She's the author of many books, including Vast Expanses, A History of the Oceans, just out this year with Reaction Books. Helen Roswedowski, thank you for talking with me.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
So your book, Vast Expanses, it's really a global history as told from the perspective of the oceans. What was your goal in changing this perspective?
Well, one way I could approach that question is to point to the way I decided to start the book. I wanted to have a kind of a part of the book that went back to evolutionary time and geologic time. And I decided to write a very deliberately ocean-centric natural history of the planet because so many versions of this kind of writing, really, once land is formed and things live on land, hardly mention the ocean at all. And so I really took quite a bit of delight in mentioning that dinosaurs happened to roam the earth during the age of mollusks, for example.
I loved that. The age of oysters.
Yes, the age of oysters.
Yeah. And in fact, I was wondering if you could, why is that, let's say, equally or an even better framework for that period of time than, let's say, the age of dinosaurs?
Well, mollusks of all kinds, oysters among them, ruled the seas of the earth at that point and were probably as characteristic, probably more characteristic and more numerous than dinosaurs, so why not?
Yeah, I was really surprised at the way that you put the first chapters of this book together, because I think for people who are listening who are not historians and they hear, you know, the term history, it might just be the study of the past, but you and I know that most of our time is spent looking at what people do. And the first two chapters of your book, you're really trying to tell a kind of history of the oceans without any humans around. And it's an unbelievably diverse story. I mean, you touch on geology, paleontology, astronomy. And I was wondering what kind of challenges that brought to you as a writer to try to tell that huge story without any people in it.
Those were some of the hardest parts for me to write. And I think it's probably not an exaggeration to say I spent a year reading science, various things to help with the natural history chapter. And I spent another year reading about early human archaeology, the exciting work that's being done right now with early hominids and with early hominid and Homo sapien and other kinds of Homo genuses, species use of marine resources and indirect evidence of human voyaging and things like that. And trying to then turn around and render that in a way that made it into history was a bigger challenge than I had expected, but was very fun to do.
So it was fun, ultimately. It just seemed like quite an incredible thing, but I was thinking it would be exceptionally challenging as a writer.
Well, yes, I'd be lying if I said that it wasn't. But what I was really trying to do was to sort of get those chapters written down, but also that those narratives help support the argument that the ocean has a history that is connected to people.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons for that is because the ocean creates the conditions for life. And I think we should take that seriously as historians.
Yeah. On this issue of the ocean as a place of life, you write in your book that 99% of the habitable environments for life on the planet are in the oceans. And I know that you are also very much an environmental historian. And I was wondering if you thought that, you know, given how much of life and the environment is in the ocean, do you think there's a problem with the way that we think about environmental history now where it's so land focused?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I'll circle around and answer it this way. When I first saw a slide in a talk by a colleague, actually, who's here at the University of Connecticut, Peter Oster, who showed that slide, and I've seen that slide in other science talks elsewhere since then, I was so struck by it. 99% of the habitable ecosystems on Earth are in the ocean. That's way more than the 71% of the ocean we're used to thinking about. And one of the reasons this had such a profound impact on me is because I've spent my career trying to encourage historians to think about the ocean not just as a surface on which human activities play out like a stage on ships and between places, but to really think about the third dimension of the ocean. That's something I suppose some of my friends might say I have a mania for. But when I saw that slide, I thought, okay, so scientists get that the volume of the ocean matters. Now, let's see if we can really turn around and show how all of the ocean, including these faraway places like hydrothermal vents, matter to history. And by that, you know, I think we sort of assume we mean human history because we're making a distinction between natural history and human history. And I'm trying to convey in this book that it does matter. And it matters precisely because humans have influence on the ocean, and the ocean has dramatically shaped human activities. And that kind of two-directional flow is exactly what we learn from environmental history.
The kind of links that you make, I was struck by the fact, for example, that in talking about human migrations, you were mentioning that, you know, you cannot tell the story of human migrations into places like Australia or the appearance of Homo floresiensis in Indonesia, which I guess has been there for at least a few hundred thousand years.
Without, they say a million.
A million years?
Yeah.
Without getting into this issue of, well, how are human beings understanding the oceans well enough to actually cross them? Yeah, it's not even a question. I was just really struck by that.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things I've learned in the research I did for this book, and of course, some of this research is based on scientific literature and some of it is more kind of primary source research like historians usually do. But what I learned from the anthropologists and the archaeologists is kind of a twofold thing. I mean, one thing I learned is that the recent research is showing amazing and very interesting things about how long ago people and hominids before Homo sapiens have been voyaging, which we know from this kind of indirect evidence, and using marine resources in many different ways. But one of the other things that was super interesting to me was to look back into the archaeological literature of up to a few decades ago and realize what a profoundly terrestrial bias archaeology had, just assuming that people wouldn't see food and didn't have the capacity to manage voyaging. And it's not like some of this evidence wasn't known before. It was just kind of inconceivable in that world. And with the kind of greater awareness, as I understand it, of where sea levels were in the past and the dawning realization that that means that people who lived close to the sea would have left their evidence behind in places that are now submerged, is really reframing the kinds of questions that it seems to me that archaeologists and anthropologists are asking about people from long ago.
I was also really struck by the way that your approach to the ocean ends up changing things that we associate with the ocean, but maybe in different ways. Like I was thinking, for example, you talk about the sublimity of the ocean. You know, it's a sublime place. It's both beautiful and terrible. Those are things that people have talked about relative to the ocean since the late 1700s, but usually it gets associated with things like storms, shipwrecks, and you are turning the attention of the reader towards the underwater world, these massive mountains that exist underwater, or the trenches that go down deeper than any terrestrial trench, or these creatures like the megalodon, if I'm saying that the right way, these 60-foot long sharks that used to live there. I'm just wondering, in the process of writing this, did any of this surprise you or stand out to you?
Well, I guess one way to answer that is to say that I think in some ways, the fact that we are, many of us, are struck by these extremes in the ocean, the fact that the ocean has the tallest mountains, the longest feature on the earth, which is the series of mid-ocean ridges, waterfalls, the biggest creatures that have ever lived, the oldest creatures that have ever lived, and so on and so on. The fact that we're struck by those things is probably conditioned by the fact that we live in a culture that has been affected by those ideas of sublimity and romanticism and things like that. And it is true that the ocean is kind of a repository for reflections along those lines. So yes, in some cases I was surprised, and in other cases I wasn't, but I was led to the kind of dawning realization that really what we see when we look at the ocean is really a reflection back of what we bring to it, what we already think, because the ocean in most cases is opaque. And so, you know, when we see sublimity and when we see romanticism in the ocean, that's largely because we bring it there. And so then it prompts me to suggest we need to put on our historian hats and ask, well, who are the actors having these thoughts, and where did these thoughts come from, and what are the pieces of documentary and artistic and literary evidence that help us see why people understood the ocean in this particular way at this particular time? Mm.
You were writing in one of the later chapters about the 19th century as a time when mariners and scientists are beginning to discover the ocean as a three-dimensional place. And I was wondering if you could talk about what's driving that.
Well, I think, though I can't claim to be an expert in the kind of 15th, 16th century, one of the things that seems to me that is happening is that new interest in various kinds of oceanic resources, especially whales and seals in Northern Ocean, North Atlantic, is causing people to be aware of animals that go underwater but have to come to the surface and breathe, parts of the ocean that maybe they haven't visited before in such great numbers, and especially reporting back that information to learned people who start writing about these things. The Swiss naturalist Conrad Gessner creating his compendium of animals, both real and imaginary, are the categories we would use today. But he has these drawings of what don't look much like whales, but are obviously intended to be whales and seals. And he has them kind of right next to these sea monsters and merpeople. And so there's a lot of interest in what is hidden under the waves, and that at a certain point in time, kind of coming off of the so-called age of geographic discovery and heading into a period of intensified European commodification of nature, that was happening with regard to ocean resources.
Did the way that these scientists looked at the ocean in the 19th century, were they trying to understand it in the same sort of way as, you know, we sometimes associate with, let's say, Humboldt or other people who are trying to create this holistic vision of the world and just applying that to the ocean? Or was it much more piecemeal? Was it a question of, well, we need to know how deep to put the telegraph cable and we need to know where the seals are, that sort of thing?
I think by the 19th century, it was much more piecemeal. And one of the reasons I think that is because simply rather than one person doing it, it was being done by different groups of people. So naturalists, dredgers interested in the question of what lived beneath the ocean, and you had hydrographers wondering how deep the ocean was and how long a cable would have to be to stretch all the way across the ocean. So I think it's pretty much more piecemeal in the 19th century than it was earlier.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
One of the things you talk about in your final chapters, and I know this is work you're doing now as well, is on the idea of the ocean as a frontier. And you start that chapter talking about how the frontier is this iconic place in American culture, something in the 19th century we associated with the American West and was, you know, it became this symbolic and cultural structure. It's something that academics like us talk about all the time. And then it gets applied to the ocean, the deep ocean in the 20th century. I'm wondering how much the 19th century American frontier shaped the way people thought about the ocean in the 20th century. And then as a kind of follow-up question, why did, let's say, that deep ocean frontier turn out so differently from other frontiers like the space frontier?
So to start with your initial question, the 19th century ideals shaped thoughts about the ocean very directly. And I would point to the work of Gary Kroll, who's given us some amazingly evocative examples of comparing whales to bison as creatures that would sadly inevitably become extinct, and we should learn about them before they do. This kind of posture that many naturalists who thought about whales in the early part of the 20th century had. Let's learn about them. It was kind of a kooky moment when a few people started trying to think about ranching them the way they ranch bison. But so there were certainly direct influences. The influence that I found to be very important to come to terms with for understanding how the undersea was constructed as a frontier in the 1950s and 60s after World War II was kind of 19th century, but it was also kind of a 20th century thing. It was mainly the idea of the frontier as articulated by the American historian Frederick Jackson Turner, who did his work between kind of the 1890s and the 1920s. And it was his argument that the frontier had a kind of formative influence on American culture and democracy that was available as a kind of a comparison point for people in the post-war period to look at the ocean and say, well, just like the West, the ocean has raw material, it has food, it has things that can help us develop industries. So the vision in the post-war period was that the oceans would be industrialized with fancy high-tech stuff, and there would be underwater engineering companies, kind of like there are aerospace companies now. And so there was this, today you see lots of people talking about the emergence of blue economies and blue tech sectors. And that was quite similar to the vision that people had in the 1950s and 60s and the set of expectations they brought to the ocean that in fact, we should want to industrialize the ocean. That isn't necessarily how we feel today, but that was very much a live impression in the 50s and 60s.
I was wondering if there was a difference between, let's say, the way that people thought about the West as a kind of place where you come up against, well, my understanding of the whole Turner thesis was that you had people from the settled East heading West and in the process interacting with American Indians and coming into confrontations with nature and in a way rejuvenating this kind of American spirit, American exceptionalism. Does that still exist in that way? I mean, if you're building, let's say, you know, ways of resource extracting the oceans and high-tech habitats and that sort of thing, it sounds very different.
The visions of it that I see in the sources that I looked at don't so much focus on the transformation to the humans or the human society. It's more of going to be an engine for economic development, expansion for space, for living, for people in general, you know, a solution to world hunger, because, of course, you can feed plankton. Always imagined feeding plankton to the poor people and keeping the other food for the rich people. But, you know, so these visions were certainly not egalitarian. But I would say some of the people who really embraced these visions were internationalists. And so they were envisioning a time when nationalism would fall away and there would be one world government, and that was considered a good thing. People like Arthur C. Clarke, who was also the space futurist. And then other people were really more in it for developing the economy of Hawaii or developing the economy of San Diego. These places where they thought that these blue economies would take off.
Simultaneously with the idea of the ocean as a frontier, you also talk about how it's becoming a place of popular culture, that beaches that I guess in the 1700s and maybe even the 1800s were kind of reviled are now a place where you want to go and spend your vacations. People are watching television shows about Jacques Cousteau and following the newest kind of sea habitats with a lot of interest. Do you think that grows out of the frontier thing, or is that kind of, I guess the question is, why do you think all of the popular culture stuff is happening at the same time that people are talking about this as a austere and extreme space as well?
I think the answer to that is very, very tightly connected to one particular invention, which is the invention of the aqualung, which led to the widespread adoption of scuba, and kind of relates to a question you mentioned earlier that we didn't circle back to, the difference between the undersea and outer space in the post-World War II period. And that is that the ocean became very much an accessible place, an accessible frontier, if you will. That was often in the kind of minds of these ocean enthusiasts, articulated in comparison to space. Well, only a few people can go to space. Well, space doesn't actually have all these amazing amounts of natural resources that we can exploit. You know, there's a sense that the ocean is more reachable and more potentially going to deliver what people need in the world right now.
One of the things that I feel strongly about when you look at things like polar exploration and space exploration is you really begin to see how important rocky structures are to human exploration. You know, it's rare that you have, let's say, a voyage just out to various points in space. They do happen. We are going to post the Webb telescope at one of the Lagrange points in space. But for the most part, we get really excited about planets and planting flags, you know, in rocky surfaces. And I know you and I have talked about this, that there's a kind of bias towards terrestrial spaces. Well, you've just written an entire book about kind of reconfiguring global history from the perspective of a non-terrestrial space. What do you think the biggest biases are as you look across this you know, huge expanse of time in which we kind of get it wrong, in which we're looking at things from a too terrestrial a point of view?
Wow, that is a tough question. One of the things I could point to is that one is in graduate school I suppose you too, there was a point at which I felt like every single book on anybody's reading list was something, 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 an empire.
Yeah.
And none of those books had anything to do with the ocean. And I now have a frame of reference that would argue against that pretty strenuously, that the oceans were very, very tied to empire, and knowledge of the oceans and ambition to operate in the oceans had being able to create usable representations of ocean space, all of those things were very tied to empire and to science. And that's a different perspective on that kind of period of history than certainly I received as a graduate student.
Yeah. I was thinking about this question as I read your chapter on Pacific Islanders, who were some of the first and most practiced, you know, navigators in the world, and how they populated these islands at extreme distances from each other, and the way that they've been described through history as these really kind of isolated peoples living these precarious right. existences. And you say, like, well, no, I mean, they actually see the ocean as a kind of almost land-based space. And I was thinking, like, wow, that is such a problem of history that comes from the framework which we're using to look at them, you know?
Right. And there's a couple of really excellent scholars that have kind of helped me understand this framing. Phil Steinberg's work on the social construction of the ocean, and Pele Hawafa's essay, The Seas of Islands, and Joyce Chaplin's work on the Pacific. But it really... putting those things together and thinking from an ocean perspective, you see that the Europeans saw and experienced the ocean very differently from the way Pacific Islanders did, to the point where it was experienced almost as if it was a different place. That's pretty striking.
It actually reminded me a bit of Karen Routledge's work. I had her on a couple months ago to talk about her new book, Do You See Ice?, in which she talks about whalers and explores coming into contact with the Inuit in Cumberland Sound, and how their view of these environments is so different. But also, because of the way they move through them, their idea of home is quite different as well, and isolation too. I wanted to ask you, I know that you live in New London and that you are a sailor, and that you've done in your own life, you've done a semester at sea as a college student, and that you've worked at Mystic Seaport. In other words, the sea is not just a subject for you, it's also a part of your life. Are there any ways in which that experience on the ocean has shaped your work, or the reverse? Are there ways in which your work has shaped the way you see the ocean?
That's super interesting. Well, I definitely think about the undersea more often than I ever did when I was a sailor. and that's, yeah. You know, that's kind of a silly thing to say, but it's also a very serious thing to say. We don't tend to interact with, unless we're a diver or something like that, with the undersea. And so many of us experience the ocean on kayaks and on beaches and ferries and swimming and things like that. And the kind of profundity of that third dimension of the ocean is not apparent, but it is very apparent to me now. I guess the former part of the question, I would say I have, I kind of consider myself a permanent, slightly shy of an able-bodied seaman, like somebody who barely is competent on a boat, even no matter how many times I go on boats, because I forget every time in the middle. And it just keeps me aware of how much knowledge that people who work on and in and with the ocean have. And that was something that influenced this book, because the question I kept asking myself was, what do these groups of people that I'm interested in looking at and asking questions about, what did they do with the ocean? But then how did they do it? Which makes you sort of step back and say, how did they create knowledge about the ocean? And then how did they use that ocean? And then you can step back one step forward and say, well, how did they come up with the ambition to ask those questions? How did their desires make them seek the knowledge that helped them to use the ocean?
Yeah.
Having a certain amount of awe for people I know who are actually super competent on boats made me very aware of how much knowledge is embedded in operating near and around the ocean.
Yeah. Helen Rozwadowski, thank you for talking with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's it for today. The music was composed by Zabrat. Make sure you check out the Time to Eat the Dogs website for podcast links and other exploration-related stuff. And if you get the chance, please take a minute to rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps make the show visible to new listeners. And if you want to recommend a guest or make a comment, feel free to contact me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. See you next week.